Roughly Speaking with Dan Rogics is brought to you by The Ivy Bookshop. The Ivy welcomes New York Times bestselling author Laura Lippman for the launch of Sunburn, a superb novel of psychological suspense about two people locked in a passionate yet uncompromising game of cat and mouse with dark secrets, forbidden desires, and inevitable betrayals, Friday, February 23rd at 7 p.m. More at theivybookshop.com or call 410-377-2966.
Hello again from the Baltimore Sun. Dan Rogics here, Sun columnist. And this is Roughly Speaking, episode 361 for Friday, February 23rd, 2018. Today is another in a series of conversations with candidates for public office in the June primary. Question: could a Democrat flip the Big Red One? The Big Red One was the name of a 1980 movie starring Lee Marvin about the 1st Infantry Division in Europe during World War II. The Big Red One in my book today refers to Maryland's 1st Congressional District, where Republican Andy Harris, one of the most conservative members of Congress, is seeking a 5th term. The Big Red One runs from Carroll County through Harford and Baltimore counties across the Chesapeake Bay to the Eastern Shore. While voters in Very Blue Maryland went big time for Hillary Clinton in 2016, voters in the 1st went for Donald J. Trump by a margin of 29 percentage points. Andy Harris won re-election that year with 67% of the vote. So could a Democrat flip the Big Red One? Until recently, no one considered the district a battleground, and many political analysts still consider it solidly red for Harris, a member of the Freedom Caucus who voted dozens of times to repeal the Affordable Care Act, even as thousands of people in the 1st District gained health insurance through it. But 2 weeks ago, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee moved Maryland's 1st into battleground status, declaring it in play with nearly 100 other House seats it will try to flip in the midterm elections in November. That decision seems to be based largely on the fundraising success of Jesse Colvin, one of the Democratic candidates in Maryland's June primary. Colvin raised more campaign money than Harris in the last quarter of 2017, taking in $219,000 to the incumbent's $156,000. Jesse Colvin is a native of Baltimore who lives now in Baltimore County, the son of a Maryland district court judge and a longtime public defender. He is 33 years old and a veteran of the Army who served with the Rangers during 4 deployments to Afghanistan. On today's show, an introduction to Jesse Colvin and where he stands on some issues: health care, the opioid epidemic, jobs, the Chesapeake, and gun violence. Why are you running for Congress?
So I'm here to tell you I do not have all the answers, but I'm running directly towards the problem. I think our leaders in Washington right now are intent on turning us against each other rather than lifting us up. And the incumbent I am running against, Andy Harris, in Maryland's 1st Congressional District, represents a breed of politician intent on enriching himself, furthering his own career, doing the bidding of party bosses, rather than doing what's right by the values of constituents and the interests of our country.
All right. We'll come back and talk some more about that after we cover the bio and let people know more about you, Jesse Colvin. So you went to the Park School. And then college, where'd you go to college?
I try not to mention it on the campaign trail, but I went to Duke University.
After Duke, where did you go?
9/11 happened my senior year of high school. I had the military recruiters on the phone that week, and my parents said, go pursue an education. So that's exactly what I did. So I went to Duke, and I studied Arabic and the Middle East. I went to Egypt for a semester abroad. And then after college...
Why did you study Arabic?
I had this burning desire and curiosity to understand the 9/11 attacks in the Middle East, and I just was going to do everything I could to understand it. So Arabic with a Palestinian professor, went to Egypt for semester abroad, and then I graduated and I bought a ticket and I went to Syria. This was 2006, so I was teaching English to Iraqi refugees. They absolutely hated our government. They had every reason to. They'd lost homes and family members. Some nearly their lives. Some of them had served as interpreters and translators for troops and diplomats on the ground. So as much as they hated D.C., Washington, and the Bush administration, they held the guys and the gals on the ground in high respect. And I could see the war had been started for spurious reasons, and we were losing, but we were also committed. And I thought Uncle Sam needed good men and women, so I came home and I joined the military.
You joined the Army?
I did.
Where did you train?
Initially, Fort Benning.
What was your first assignment?
So I came in with Arabic and Middle East background, so of course they sent me to South Korea as my first assignment.
You went to the DMZ?
Yeah, we were part of the, I was the only intelligence officer for the first set of combat units near the DMZ in the peninsula. So we were essentially the tripwire. And I spent a lot of time on the campaign trail right now talking about why a war of choice with North Korea would be an absolute unmitigated disaster. And that's from having you don't need to be the intelligence officer to see the war plans to understand that a nuclear war or full-scale conventional war would be an absolute unmitigated disaster.
The choice to go into the military was mostly inspired by what happened on 9/11.
Yeah.
Had you thought about it at all prior to that as a high school student, a college student? Or?
I think my parents had a law school picked out for me when I was born. I thought I wanted to be a journalist. My life really changed on 9/11. You know, Duke at the time had this scholar from Iraq as part of the State Department program of scholars and threat, essentially. So they brought him over from Baghdad and saved his life. And I used to go and sit every Saturday, visit with him and talk about, he'd just teach me about the country, about the region, about the language, about the culture. And I was just determined to run towards the problem and try to, in my own way, in my own part, make a contribution.
Did you have a thought about the invasion of Iraq and then also our operation in Afghanistan?
So I could tell that it was started for spurious reasons and the justifications were, and I also saw it firsthand. I was living in Damascus, Syria. There were hundreds of thousands of Iraqi refugees. But you could also tell if we got it wrong in Iraq, it was going to bleed over into Syria and the rest of the region. This is pre-Syrian civil war. This is 2006. So as much as I was against the war, I knew Uncle Sam, or I decided Uncle Sam needed good men and women. And I've been the beneficiary of such a wonderful upbringing, and I language skills, a cultural skills, a college degree. I just felt obligated to serve. Public service is something I probably had in my blood even before I could recognize it in myself.
How long were you in the Army?
I did 6 years.
And did you go to Afghanistan?
I did. So I did 4 combat deployments to Afghanistan.
You went to the Rangers School?
I went to Rangers School, and then I was lucky enough to have an opportunity to try out for the Rangers, the unit, the Army Rangers, the 75th Ranger Regiment. Just a big deal in the past. And so my deployments to Afghanistan were with, as an intelligence officer, with the Rangers.
Well, tell us about that. What was your experience like in Afghanistan? You said 4 tours?
Yep. Early on in my first deployment, one of my bosses pulled me aside and said, you know, I fired the last 3 guys in your job. I said, okay, sir, what does that mean for me? And he said, I don't care if you have enough time or energy or resources, or you don't like the people you have to work with, or the Afghan allies we're working with aren't up to the task. If you don't get the job done, we're going to fire you. So you have to figure it out. I had a team of 20, 25 analysts. We were making 50 decisions a day with life or death consequences. And it's just, you learn leadership. I'm very grateful for the opportunity. I may have more responsibility at 27 than I might ever have again in my life. I felt incredibly committed to the mission. I felt incredibly committed to the guys and gals I was serving with. In my second deployment, the Marines, we were in southern Afghanistan, and we were the special operations, Rangers and special operations. The Marines we were helping out were losing on average about a limb and a half a day to bombs, to Taliban bombs. And if we did our job at night, we were doing night raids and airstrikes. That was our primary mission. You could see it. That meant a Marine didn't lose his arm or leg that day. And we could have a long conversation about whether we should be there in the first place, but I didn't have that luxury. When I signed up, the war was already happening, and to be there and say, hey, team, we did our job today and some Marine gets to come home, so that's a big deal.
So having been there, and we're still there,
yep,
all these years later, now you're running for Congress.
Yeah.
What's the answer to that question? Should we be there? How do we get out of there?
Yeah, and I have every reason to want to tell you we should get out tomorrow. I walk around with a bracelet of a Ranger buddy killed in Afghanistan. If we stay, there really isn't a good reason to stay, and we're working with a very flawed partner. We're going to continue to have to spend blood and treasure. If we leave, there's going to be an attack hatched by ISIS or Al-Qaeda inside of Afghanistan's borders, and we're going to have to go back in. So the reality is it's going to be a multi-generational conflict, and if anyone's telling you otherwise, it's because they're pandering to you or lying or just naive. It's going to take a generation, maybe multi-generations. The Afghan war has its driver's license now. It's that old. It's over 16 years old.
Right.
But the reality is it's just going to take a generation. Folks don't want to hear that. There are no easy answers here, and I'm just not going to pander or lie about it.
Do you find, since you've been campaigning now for a while, or just talking to people generally about our involvement in Afghanistan, are people that interested in it? I mean, I'm sure they ask you when you tell them you're a veteran. Because if you told me that we were on a bus together, I'd ask you that question.
Sure.
But I always wonder about how much interest the American public has in this, or is even aware of what we're doing there anymore.
It's hard to tell. I move in circles where veterans' issues are at the forefront. My wife runs a nonprofit to prevent military veteran suicide. It's hard to tell. I think most folks, in my experience on the campaign trail, what I hear and see is a sentiment to understand what exactly the threats are overseas, and if there are threats, why are we places, and what's the investment? I think Washington has done a terrible job of explaining to folks back in districts, this is where we are, this is why we're here, this is how long we can expect to be here, this is why it's worth it.
Well, that's why I ask. I think it's the lack of interest. One of the biggest gaps in American society, I think, is between people who serve in the military and those of us who don't.
Yeah.
It's a pretty wide gap.
I try to straddle that. We have some really fundamental structural issues in American politics today. We could talk about gerrymandering. We could talk about campaign finance. Another one that's lurking, and it's really hard to deal with, but we need to, is the widening civil-military gap. I couldn't agree more with it.
After the Army, you had, looks like, a series of jobs: Control Risks Group, Barclays Capital, Toffler Associates. Want to talk about each of those just a little bit so we understand what your experience is? What was Control Risks Group? What did you do there?
Yeah, absolutely. So I got out and had the availability of the GI Bill to me. So I went and got a master's at Columbia University in New York, and I studied security policy. I'd just been the guy on the ground being asked to execute security policies, and I just wanted to know who writes these things, and so that's what I did in grad school. Huh. Control Risks, I worked on due diligence investigations to try to understand if a client wanted to know, hey, before I do a merger with this other company, who are the folks I'm going to be working with? Barclays is very interesting. I was at a veterans networking event, and this woman from an investment bank walked up to me and said, the bank is looking for guys like you.
What's a guy like you? Someone who had been in intelligence?
She said, no, we're still dealing with the same reckless and irresponsible behaviors that led to the housing crisis. We're trying to clean up shop. So we want to guys and gals from military intelligence backgrounds, from the Bureau, the FBI, looking to clean up shop. So that was
in Barclays,
inside the investment bank.
It sounds like an interesting job.
It was.
Did you find internal wrongdoing?
We did. We absolutely did. We could have a separate conversation about whether the goal was to clean up shop as much as possible, or whether getting the program together and the appearance of really going after it in all corners was the goal. If we have reckless and irresponsible behavior when it pops up on Wall Street, it's related to culture. A lot of those employees come in right out of college or right out of young business school, and they adopt the culture they see when they walk through the door.
And what is Toffler Associates?
Toffler Associates is a consulting company. You may remember Alvin Toffler, who wrote a book called Future Shock.
Oh, yeah.
And so he is a consulting company founded by Alvin Toffler, and we helped private companies try to understand the disruptions they would face and the opportunities they might have in the future, which really means helping them create jobs. For the public sector, we'd help them increase efficiency and understand what was going to happen to their industry and their workforce and their technology in the next couple of years to help them prepare.
Have you been a registered Democrat your whole voting life?
My parents are lifelong Democrats, and I, at 18, I registered as an independent. I think it was because I was just an 18-year-old, and if my parents went one way, I was going to go the other way. Today, I'm a very proud Democrat.
Why are you a Democrat? What makes you a Democrat?
My political heroes are President Roosevelt, FDR, and President Truman. We owe them a lot. FDR saved the country and led us through the Great Depression. It would have not have been solved with a tax bill or tax reform. I'm very frustrated that on national security, Democrats are portrayed as somehow less credible or weak. President Truman and FDR won World War II. President Truman is also the guy who desegregated the armies.
What do you think makes a Democrat today? What do you think the party should stand for?
One thing that really scares me in this primary is I'm running against Andy Harris in Maryland's 1st Congressional District. We can't do his work for him. And by that, I mean the Bernie Sanders wing of the party, and I hate these labels, but the traditional or Clinton wing of the party.
The mainstream Democratic Party.
If we can't figure out a way to understand that we're all on the same team and we share the same values and the same goals, we just have different approaches to get there.
Say those values are. I just want to take a minute with you so I understand. What are your values as a Democrat?
Yeah, I think at the core, it's government is not the solution to every problem for every person for all time, but government can be a force to improve people's lives. What does the Republican Party stand for right now? I don't know. I think they're going through on their own side, their own existential crisis. But I think on our side, especially in this primary, we have to figure out a way. If we do Andy Harris's work for him, or whoever comes out of this primary bloodied, we're just doing his work for him. So we have to figure out a way to work together as a team. And remember that we have the common goal here is to get a Democrat in the seat currently occupied.
Yeah, but why? What would change? This might sound like a fundamental question, but it's very fundamental to me.
Sure.
It's like, all right, you're asking me as an independent, say you win the primary, and I'm an independent living in the first congressional district, and last time I voted for Harris.
Sure.
How are you going to convince me to vote for you? Why a Democrat this time?
You know, we're making this a referendum about Andy Harris. This is not a referendum on left versus right or the Democratic Party versus the Republican Party. It's not about the president. It's about Andy Harris. And so I say to that question, let me tell you about my platform. At the top of the platform, I want to talk to you about healthcare and the opioids crisis. I want to talk to you about jobs of the future, and I want to talk to you about the Chesapeake Bay.
What about healthcare and the opioid crisis? What would you do about it?
Yeah, so opioids, this congressional district is getting hammered. It's the fatalities are twice the national average. It's bad. I used to go into living rooms and ask by a show of hands, who's been personally affected by the epidemic or know somebody? I've long since stopped asking because the answer is everybody. If you want to pay this lip service, you put together some sort of task force. It's going to be law enforcement. It's going to be just on the prevention side. And you're going to do a couple arrests and you end up on the 6 o'clock news and that's that. If you really want to get into it, you need money for prevention, not just law enforcement. You know, the YMCA in Easton, Maryland, for example, has a phenomenal program. There are hundreds of kids there from 2:30 in the afternoon to 6:30. And that's the vulnerable age and the vulnerable time. And then it's treatment and recovery. And if you really want to work our way through this crisis and out of it and put a dent into it, you have to talk about treatment and recovery.
Isn't Andy Harris aware of these things? He's a doctor. Hasn't he supported more funding for treatment for the opioid crisis?
No. So, the fatalities in this congressional district since he's taken over are twice the national average. That's about the best way I could summarize his approach to this crisis.
Is that his fault?
I think this gets back to leadership. If you're the congressman in the district, it's on your shoulders. So you're responsible for what's happening, whether you were paying attention to it or not. So that's opioids. You want to talk about healthcare?
Well, you brought it up. So what about healthcare and Andy Harris?
So just to remind your listeners, there are 54,000 people in this congressional district who are dependent on the ACA in some form or fashion. Andy Harris is trying to repeal it with no backup plan. By the way, there are 50,000 jobs in this congressional district in the healthcare industry. It's the biggest, in terms of jobs and industry, it's at the top of the list. So just to come in with no backup plan, the stakes are just too high. So that's step one, just to recognize that.
The Chesapeake Bay, what would you say about Andy Harris's record on the Chesapeake Bay?
Right. So if you look at the budget that just got passed through the House and from the White House, the Bay funding, it got cut by 90%. People remember the Superstorm Sandy relief vote because there are 535 people in Congress. And when it comes to being the number one defender of and protector of and advocate for and champion of the Chesapeake Bay, it has to be, in my mind, the representative from Maryland's first. So that's just plain and simple.
And you say he's not?
Correct. So I mean, he has a 3% lifetime voting record from the League of Conservation Voters. So.
And what do you mean by jobs of the future?
Yeah, we need to talk about jobs of the future. So I'll give you a couple examples. Chesapeake College, there's a string of 2 and 4-year colleges in this congressional district. There is no reason Chesapeake College cannot have one of the state's best or country's best solar programs. So imagine you go to college for 2 years. When you come out, you can sell the panels, you can fix them, you can maintain them. There's no reason. It's one of the fastest growing industries in the country, fastest growing industries in the state. There's no reason a Chesapeake College couldn't have that. Hartford Community College or Cecil College should have one of the country's best cybersecurity programs. Aberdeen Proving Grounds is around the corner. Fort Meade is not that far away. The federal government is looking for the next generation of cybersecurity folks, and all these schools, that if you go get certified and you go get registered and we expand these programs, you know, this is going to be the next generation of jobs. And I'll give you the last one, Warwick Community College in the Lower Shore. It's right across the state border from Wallops Island, and that's where SpaceX, they have this, you know, as a launch facility. The engineers coding for the rockets themselves, they're going to come from Harvard and Carnegie Mellon. But the 98% other jobs down there, there's no reason Warwick couldn't be a feeder school for hard engineering, soft engineering, the business administration, everything that goes into it. And the last thing, we have a broadband issue, Dan, in this congressional district. In rural parts of this district, particularly in the Eastern Shore, it's a huge connectivity issue. And if you want your kids to be able to do homework at home, it's 2018. They need high-speed internet. If you want entrepreneurs to create jobs, it's 2018. They have to have access to high-speed internet.
Was there a particular thing about Andy Harris or the political scene of the last few years that got you thinking, I should run for Congress?
I never thought I'd be pursuing political office, and I really have every reason not to be. My wife and I just got married last year. We have a baby on the way. I had a really fulfilling job. At some point after the presidential election, I turned to her and said, honey, we have to get involved. And she runs this nonprofit to prevent military veteran suicide. So she said, well, I'm doing pretty good work. You go figure it out. And so I looked around the country. I don't know if you know this, there are about 30 military veterans running for Congress this cycle. And I'm young, I'm 33, but I looked at their war records and their academic backgrounds and their business backgrounds, and I saw a lot of myself. And then I looked in our own backyard. We live in Baltimore County, so it's Andy Harris. And I said, we have to do it. And we're living off a single income. We are not independently wealthy. Our healthcare is going to be coming through the exchange, or it is coming through the exchange. I'm one of these veterans who never thought I'd be pursuing political office, but just...
What was it particular? Was it Trump's election?
North Korea. Everything in North Korea really scares me. I think if you look at the apparatus around the decision-making in Washington to make sure that we don't go off the rails and just because of a Twitter fight launch into what will be an unmitigated disaster, that scares me. Healthcare, you know, I'm on the phone with the insurance companies myself dealing with trying to get my pregnant wife the medications we need. And you got a guy who's trying to take away healthcare from 54,000 people. When I say I don't have all the answers, but I'm running directly towards the problem, it's not just a line, it's true. I don't have all the answers, but I'm running directly towards the problem.
Well, let's say you won the primary. I looked at the voter registration for the first district. There's 188,000 Democrats, almost 100,000 independents. Yep. There's 235,000 Republicans. Yep. And the district went for Trump last time. Yep. Andy Harris would be seeking his fifth term. So what makes you think you can beat him?
Yeah.
Can you flip the first?
Yeah. So the answer is yes. The time is now, and I'm the guy to do it. And here's why. When I first talked to the National Party, they weren't quite going through the drawers trying to find the map for Maryland's first. After the gerrymander we experienced in 2011, this district for many folks was long considered
red.
Red. Unwinnable. And I spoke with the National Party, and they said, give us your elevator pitch. And I gave, you know, I'm this fourth generation Marylander, I'm an Army Ranger, my wife's a Republican, and I'm running against Andy Harris. And they said, okay, that sounds like a good story, let's meet. And it said, go forth and create your own viability, show us that you're serious, and come back. So we went out last quarter, our first quarter of fundraising, we actually outraised Andy Harris, which is a big deal. He's never been outraised by a challenger. It turned a lot of heads, and it sends a signal this is in play. The National Party has now added this district to its list of 101, what they're calling the battleground districts, the districts they consider in play across the country. If you'd said 6 months ago, Maryland's first is going to be on the list, people would have given you a really weird look. So when I go out there, you know, we're asking people to consider that this job is ultimately about leadership, and it's ultimately about results, and I come in and I want to talk about the opioid epidemic and healthcare and jobs of the future and Chesapeake Bay. That resonates. And what I'm hearing and seeing on the campaign trail is, you know, we're making this a referendum about Andy Harris. And people, you know, there are some folks who recognize that he's been focused elsewhere, whether it's in D.C. local politics. He wrote a letter to his House colleagues last month, 2 months ago, about cutting independent media in Hungary. The State Department funds media in Hungary in order to have a healthy, productive media in that country, because the prime minister there, if you look at the Wall Street Journal, said it's not a dictator, but it's a dictator and happening. People want to know where their representative is and why he's focused on everything else. Forget whether that's a good idea or a bad idea. It's not a good idea what he's working on, but why aren't you working on the issues at home that I care about?
What was the weapon you carried in Afghanistan?
So our primary weapon was an M4, which is a rifle, and then our secondary weapon was a pistol. And it, depending on the time and situation, it might have been a Glock or something else. But so primary rifle, secondary pistol.
And we have the AR-15 in the United States. It's used frequently in mass killings, most recently in Florida.
Yeah.
So someone stands up at a town hall in Salisbury and says, "Mr. Colvin, where are you on this?"
Yeah.
What do you say?
So the first thing is, I did not deploy, volunteer deploy to Afghanistan for 4 times to come home and watch. I have a son coming in 7 weeks, and I don't want my son or your kids or grandkids or anybody else's kids getting murdered in school. So the time for thoughts and prayers is over. The second thing is, gun violence and mass shooting represent a public health crisis in this country. I also don't know how we can talk about mass shootings and gun violence without addressing the fact that in some of our communities, especially in a place like Baltimore City where we're sitting today, they experience gun violence at disproportionate rates. My wife, my Republican wife, by the way, who is a police officer in Washington, D.C., to say she does not like guns would be a massive understatement. Most of her giving is to the Giffords Foundation. She will tell you that most police officers in D.C. do not like guns because when guns are being shot at them by the bad guys, it's because some responsible gun owner, using air quotes here, left their pistol unsecured in a glove box or a house. The Democratic Party needs folks who can speak credibly on this issue. As a former Army Ranger who just asked me what weapons I carried in Afghanistan and my wife and her background, we need folks who can credibly talk. I attended some training at the national headquarters. And they brought some folks out from every town and from the Giffords Foundation, and they said, if you're a candidate or you're working for a candidate who doesn't understand the basic nomenclature, what 556, difference between 556 and 762, you have to understand that because they're going to try to trip you up.
You mean on weapons?
On weapons.
Yeah.
So we have an opportunity here. So Florida represents a moment of exhaustion and shame, and we need to take advantage of it. So some of the basics. The president has signaled that he would work on the bump stock issue. Great. Let's hold his feet to the fire. Background checks.
Extensive federal background checks.
Background checks. Great. Let's go there. Let's hold their feet to the fire. There are a couple things we should. This window is so fleeting, I fear, and so narrow. Let's do what we can right now. Let's talk about the.
I'm not going to do it with the Republican Congress.
The moment of shame is here, and we have to try. We have to try, and
I think they'll try, but getting it through a Republican Congress doesn't seem likely to me.
So here's a little bit of glimmer of hope that we have to drive a semi-truck through. Senator Rubio, Marco Rubio of all people, signals support for it's a red flag, domestic violence red flag restraining order. That's a big deal that he even publicly came out and said that. Great. Let's hold his feet for fire. Let's not let them forget they said that 2 weeks from now. We have a moment. We need to drive a Mack truck through that window of opportunity.
What about a ban on assault rifles?
We
have one in Maryland.
We have a ban on Maryland, and we also have in Baltimore City. We have a great set of laws in the state, and we have a community in Baltimore City that experiences violence at disproportionate rates. I will be happy to work on any bill that keeps our kids safer and keeps our streets safer and keeps our community safer.
So an assault rifle ban.
So I think right now the window is so fleeting and so narrow that we need to make sure what we can do right now. If I were privileged enough to be serving right now, here's what I would focus on. We just talked about a couple of them. Bump stocks. We talked about this red flag restraining order. We talked about...
But I straight up asked you whether you would support an assault rifle ban. You're not ready to answer that?
I think if we start going down the list of what about assault weapon bans, what about high capacity magazines, what about this, 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 and this, the wish list would be really long. I would love, let's recognize that this window is narrow and fluid. There is shame.
I understand you're saying you have to take this a step at a time.
Correct.
But a lot of people in your own party are going to be asking candidates, do you support an assault rifle ban? You're going to be asked that question this year, and so I'm asking you now.
The president recently, in the last 24 hours, has signaled his support to talk about assault weapon bans from 18 to 21. That is a huge deal. If that's their opportunity right now, then we have to drive a Mack truck through that opportunity. It is fleeting and is narrow, and because of this shame...
But how do you personally feel about it?
I feel like
Do you think these weapons should be sold in the United States anymore?
I feel like I want to keep my kids safe. I feel like I want to let the CDC be able to study this issue as a public safety health crisis. I feel like we we have to understand that we're living through a massive crisis. We also need to understand.
Well, it's pretty clear by now, isn't it? I mean, the AR-15,
right,
this basic weapon with, right, with additions on it, is used in frequently in mass killings, right?
Absolutely.
We had a ban on it once.
We did. But let's talk about the CDC for a second. There's President Obama famously said, I can't even get the CDC to be able to study this issue as the public health crisis as it is. There are so many things to prevent these shootings and and violence in our communities that if we had cooperation on both sides of the aisle and we had a clear path forward, we could do all of them. That's just not, the moment is fleeting and is narrow, and I'm not going to sit here and pander to you or anyone else, Dan, and say, hey, I think we can get all these stuff done. So the one thing you didn't talk about.
I didn't ask you that, whether you could get it all done. I just asked whether you supported a ban on assault rifles. Maryland has one.
It does. We also have a massive violence issue, disproportionate, and some of our communities.
We don't have mass killings. We have street killings by handgun in Baltimore City. That's the gun problem in Maryland and suicides. But we don't have, so far, knock on wood or something, we don't have a mass killing on our hands.
So let me tell you how seriously I'm taking this topic. Since the Florida shooting, I've reached out to several groups at the state and the federal level. So I've been working with every town. I've been working with a group called Marylanders to Prevent Gun Violence. There's another great group. If your listeners want to get involved at a local level, moms, mothers of murdered sons and daughters, there's some Ceasefire Maryland. There's some great groups out there. We on the left, as angry as we are and as sad as we are and as much as we want to fix this overnight, it is a huge deal right now that you have just this window of opportunity, and if we need to take advantage of what we can now, and then let's talk about the next thing.
Do you support carrying concealed weapons?
Right, so let's talk about my opponent for a second. My opponent is trying to roll back this regulation that to conceal carry reciprocity from state to state. Andy Harris, by the way, has an A rating from the NRA.
Andy Harris supports a federal law allowing you to carry a concealed weapon from state to state.
So you asked, you were really focusing on assault weapons ban. I would tell you, rather than focusing on assault weapons ban right now, that is the next hurdle. What I just talked about, pump stocks, the restraining order. You haven't asked me about information sharing, but that's something we have an opportunity to do right now to prevent these mass shootings. The next hurdle is going to be this concealed carry bill that is there are forces out there right now trying to get through Congress and through the Senate and the White House. That is the next hurdle. So that's where we need to focus our time and energy, because that is the next fight.
Well, we'll see you again sometime, maybe before the June primary. Thanks for being here, Jesse.
Dan, thank you very much for having me. Very much appreciated.
Jesse Colvin is a Democratic candidate in the 1st Congressional District in his party's June 26th primary. I earlier interviewed another candidate, Allison Galbraith, and you can find a link to that episode 324, in the notes with this podcast. Representative Andy Harris and any other candidates in the 1st are invited to be heard on this program as well. Just get in touch. That's our show for now. Your thoughts are welcome by email, Twitter, or on Facebook. Please review our show in iTunes if you get a chance. We really appreciate it. For producers Steve Early and Quinn Kelly, I'm Dan Rodericks. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking from the Baltimore Sun. Have a good weekend, and we'll see you again soon.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. Located at 6080 Falls Road, more information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966.